The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
This episode of the Old Dogs REI Network is brought to you by Mino Studio.
In a world where jobs are how most people make money, one man, one desire, one challenge dares to break the mold. Welcome to the Old Dogs REI Network, where we don't work for money. Money works for us. Coming soon, viewer discretion advised.
Welcome to the Old Dogs REI Network, where cash flow is king. Real estate investing, the means, so you can enjoy your retirement dreams. This is the show where we cut right to the chase. No sales pitch, no long monologues, just simple how-to real estate investing advice, so you can earn the passive income you need to enjoy your retirement today. And now, your host and chief old dog, Bill Manassero.
Welcome to the Old Dogs REI Network. I'm your host, Bill Manassero, and this is the show where 50-plussers and anyone else who wants to join us get solid, no-sales-pitch real estate investing advice to help generate real cash flow. This podcast airs twice weekly on Mondays and Fridays, and if you aren't already a subscriber, go to iTunes or Apple Podcasts, type in Old Dogs, spelled D-A-W-G-S, find our podcast, and subscribe. Well, we've got a great show for you today. I'm looking forward to it. We're going to be talking about syndication. We're going to be talking about international investing and a lot of things that, we've kind of touched on and we've had shows on in the past, but I think we're coming in from a different aspect. The gentleman that's on is on the operator side as well as on the investor side of syndications. And I'm talking about Charles Carrillo. And he is the managing partner of Harborside Partners, a real estate syndication firm, and has been actively involved in multifamily real estate since 2006. Charles also hosts the Global Investors Podcast, where he interviews professionals about investing in U.S. real estate. Well, Charles, welcome to the Old Dogs REI Network.
Thanks so much for having me on, Bill. It's great to be here.
Well, it's great having you. You certainly don't look like you're an old dog, but we're going to let you on anyway. You know, I think you've got some good, you know, we can learn stuff from the young pups out there as well. So, I'd like to hear a little bit about your background and, where you came from and how you got, ended up in this real estate world.
So I grew up in my dad was a real estate investor before the time I was born, so like 80s and 90s. And when it was my second education, I call it, starting in elementary school with my dad. And he probably had 100 plus rental units and mixed use properties and stuff like this. And he self-managed them with a small team. And my dad was a little bit more hands-on. He never had a third party manager for it. So when his superintendents or when people that were working for him kind of dropped the ball or weren't around or something like this, we would be collecting rent. We would be dealing with contractors and everything that kind of goes hand in hand. My dad, I typically consider him like an old school investor in the sense of when I started really getting more into syndication and you start hearing all these cool formulas and all these different ways of valuing properties. And my dad was a real, when I say old school investor, I say like back of the napkin kind of guy. And we would meet other guys that were older than my dad, and we at like Friendly's or other places like that. I'm originally from Connecticut. I moved to Florida in 2012, And they would be like, you know, these guys had this as their office, and you'd go in there and they'd negotiate deals like literally on the back of napkins. And I had no idea what was really going on. But, you know, he dealt with some brokers, and the whole process is kind of where I got my start. I started buying multifamily myself. My dad kind of pushed me into it when I got out of college, and I wanted to do it beforehand, but I didn't really. My dad kind of just like really instilled in me to buy a property, and I bought a three-family property I still own today, and I rented out two floors. I lived on one floor with a roommate, and then a couple years later in 08, I bought another property, and then 09, I bought another property, and that's kind of how my role went. And then in 2012, I moved to Florida. I had any properties I bought up there, I have under professional management right now. And since we've been down in Florida, we've been really focusing on larger syndication type properties. So really 75 plus units on the active side and $5 million plus purchase prices.
Now, with the syndication, had your father done any syndications prior?
My dad had been in syndications before, and but they weren't in real estate. He was in some other ones like oil and gas and other industries that he wasn't really familiar with. And he had lost money in one of them. And then he actually went back with the operator again, and he was paid on it for like 30 years. So it goes like to show you, when you're investing in one of these things, you're investing more into the operator and not really into the operator's number one. And I kind of learned that hands on with him. He was it was funny, not real. I mean, funny from my point of view, but in the early 90s, late 80s, when real estate was going crazy, kind of how it is now. And he was introduced to a syndicator up in Connecticut. It's the syndicator actually was running a huge Ponzi scheme. Actually, one of the passive investors was actually Donald Trump. And they actually, the whole thing went down. It was the house that Tyson bought up there. And they built this huge thing in the center of Connecticut. And so he avoided that. He never got into it. And I think that kind of shaped him. He's like, no, I'm never going to passively invest. And he never really looked for deals like that. But also the vetting wasn't around like it is today. I mean, you can't really vet people as effectively back then than you would today. It's mostly more, and I think back then it was more of a like country club setting when you're buying larger apartment complexes, where it's a few people, they get together. Hey, I know someone that's buying something. You should talk to this person. And today, with all the podcasts, with all of the information that's out there, you can really find people that weren't referred to you that might have worked with someone, and you can really get down to the bottom and figure out exactly how some person really operates if you become an investor of theirs.
It's true. You were also in another business, so I mean, you were right out of school. It looks like you had some sort of an online business, right?
Yeah, I was running an online business. I started. It was a kind of a niche payment processing business, which I merged it with one that my brother had years back, and he runs that full time now. And it was something that years back we were focusing a lot with on international accounts, and we had partners that were international. So I would actually spend 2 or 3 months a year, mainly in Eastern Europe, and with partners I had over there, and with clients that had over there. And they would always ask me, oh, what else you're investing in? Because these were business people. And they're like, what, you know, I was, oh, real estate. And they would ask me, how do I invest in real estate? Because I'm telling them, you know, going through the whole list of things, right? This is how you do it. This is why it's great, all this kind of stuff. And not that I was syndicating, but I was just kind of like really pumped about it. And it was funny because they would always ask me, how do I do it? And I was like, oh, I don't know. You know, I'm not international. I'm not foreign. I don't know exactly. I just kind of know, hey, we have these great financing for U.S. people and all this stuff that happens. And I never really dug into other countries and kind of what happens there and what kind of opportunities are available for real estate investors. But you quickly find out that in a lot of countries, the cash flow is not really a thing. You know what I mean? And when you talk to international investors, that's like the first thing I'll ask when I talk to them. And you got to get a feel of where they're coming from, because it's like, you know, if you're based in New York City and New York City is all you know and all you are regular with, I mean, you're not really going to be cash flowing like if you were buying a property in Columbus, Ohio, for example. You know what I mean? And so it's something that these investors want to spread to different markets and invest into different areas that could be have growth that would you know, surpass what they would receive in another market somewhere in the country or in the world that they're investing into. So very interesting.
And you're once you're online business sort of merged with your brothers, then were you still active, or did you kind of step away and move more into real estate full time?
We're actually hiring another person right now. And it's kind of like when I stepped back from it, I really put together a lot of processes and systems in place there. And my brother really handles a lot of the marketing aspect of it. And then we just have someone that takes care of a lot of the what we call like an account executive back and forth. So we have two of those people now. And I probably spend 2 or 3 hours a week on that, just kind of seeing how everything goes. If there's larger accounts that come through, it might be something that we'll handle ourselves. But mainly, I would consider myself a full-time real estate investor.
Gotcha. Now, you started small, like you talked about. You know, you picked up some smaller, multis. And then it looked like in 2009 is when you bought your first commercial property. Was that a large multi-unit apartment, or what kind of commercial property was that?
It was a mixed-use property, so it had it was commercial on the bottom, most of the bottom floor, and then above it was all residential. So I think like if you did it by square footage, probably 90% of the square footage was residential, and a small portion, the rest of it was an office space, and It was great. I mean, it was a great. We used the office as our office for years. That's really why we bought it. But back then in 2009, I purchased this in December of 2009, and I refinanced it a few years back. But you couldn't get any type of loan for that. There's no banks that were lending on that. It was crazy. And it's amazing now when I talk to people like that same property, how many people want to buy it, and I get contacted to purchase that property. And then when I talk to other people in other markets and they say, oh, I put up a property like that and I get 80 calls or something and I have an offer right away. And that's kind of how crazy we are right now in 2021. But back in 2009, that thing was sitting on the market for over 4 months. And it was sitting on the market for, I think, probably 40% what it was sold for, like a year before or something, year and a half before. And I came in and I did 30% less than that. And they said, well, you know, we have one more offer on it. Give us your best and final. And I think I went up like 2%, and they took it. And it was crazy. I talked to him when I handed that property over to my property manager. He couldn't believe it, how little I paid for it. But did a whole renovation on it, got it fully rented within 90 days, and held it without a mortgage for years, and then refinanced it later on when I found the right product from a bank I wanted to use, because I don't like really refinancing them through. I like long-term fixed debt. It just makes it very minimal risk when you're doing it that way.
Mm-hmm. And so you initially purchased it for cash then, right?
Yeah, I purchased it with cash. And that was the reason why anybody looked, because you wouldn't be able to. That's the only way you could buy back then. Because if it was a four-unit property, it would have moved quicker. I don't know how fast, but it would have moved quicker if it was four units. But when you get into the five units and above, that's when it's considered a commercial property. When it's considered a commercial property, that's when you're not getting in on 3.5% down. You're doing something now like 25% down. Back then, it probably was even more. I didn't even look. I mean, I imagine it was 30 or 35% down. I know now a lot of the local banks in that market, they want 40%. You know, so with everything with COVID, and you don't really hear about how you know, with the larger multifamily stuff, you know, you always hear, okay, there's bridge lenders that are available, which is like hard money lenders here for commercial. And then you hear, hey, everybody wants to loan on 1 to 4 units. And you hear Fannie and Freddie Mac, which is the larger players, agency loans that people use for $1 million plus loan amounts when you're dealing on large multifamily. And those guys are loaning, so everything's fine. But really, a lot of smaller banks I have found, not a lot, but a percentage of them, a sizable percentage of them, have kind of tightened up their belt since COVID, and they're not lending. I was talking to one just a couple months ago. And so you're talking literally a year after COVID started here in the U.S. and still not lending unless you have 40% equity. And so it's, you know, that's just their way of saying they're not lending anymore on that product. So very interesting.
Yeah, it is interesting. Do you... When did you get into syndication first time?
So got involved with syndication in 2018. It was interesting because I had people that were asking me to invest with me, and I kind of didn't have prior to that, I was like, oh, you know, I don't have a vehicle for this. As I'm thinking to myself, like, I don't have a vehicle to use this. And I kind of came to the realization, which was kind of my light bulb moment, as you would call it, where it was, hey, you know, this is the way I'm going to have to grow my business going into larger assets, or it's really just going to be me buying nothing wrong with 5 and 7 unit properties, but the ability to scale that, especially if you're, when you start bringing in investors, the pie really gets diminished because in these syndications, the majority of the money is actually going to the passive investors. So it's something where if you're the operator, you really have to have a sizable portfolio and be doing sizable deals for it to become, for it to be profitable and worth your time, really.
Right. So you came in as an LP on that first one?
Yeah, I came on an LP on one on my first one, and then after it, I connected with a couple groups of investors that were investing down in Florida, and I'm based in Florida, so it was great, and some markets that I like down here, and that's where we really started from. And I still have all my properties in Connecticut still; they're professionally managed, but the ones in Florida, mainly those are all in, you know, syndications and larger properties. I think our smallest one is 59 units.
Now, you're going into syndication, of course, you know, you're going to need a pool of investors to draw upon. Where did you find those investors to be able to do some of those deals?
The thing I had that was great was that I had been in it for so many years before taking money from investors, and it was literally 13 years I was investing in real estate before taking a penny from a passive investor, right? And it was something that I started building it out. I started a podcast talking about, because I was really focusing on, because I had my first investor was actually an expat and based in Europe, one of my partners previously from our payment company. And he wanted to invest, and I didn't know how to do everything, and I figuring out how this would all work. So when I did that initially, that's kind of when I launched the podcast that was on foreign investors investing in U.S. real estate. And it just, that's kind of the niche, and the majority, I think about half my listeners are foreign. And once I had that, that was something that kind of rolled, because it was a niche that didn't get much attention to. Most syndicators are spending their time finding accredited investors here in the U.S., which is fantastic. But I mean, accredited investors are, I was reading, only about 8% of the population here in the U.S. So that makes it very difficult. I mean, it cuts the amount of people you have to find to a small amount that everybody's looking for, right? Every guy with a deal, girl with a deal is looking for that small percentage of accredited investors. So when going and opening up and really broadening horizons in the niche of doing that, that's how I started to build in my investor pool. But I would say probably two-thirds of probably our investors are in the U.S., and I would say one-third is probably abroad in some capacity, that they spend a sizable amount of time abroad, whether they come back to the U.S. or they're in other places.
And where are they coming? From what countries are you seem to be drawing the most?
So Eastern Europe is a big one. Hong Kong, for my wife's work previously, used to spend about two months a year in Hong Kong for her work. And that all ended right before COVID, or when COVID was going on over there and it hadn't really hit over here. So we haven't been back in about a year and a half. But when that was happening, that was something that I went to a lot of real estate meetups over there, and a lot of people looking to invest in all different countries, very open to international investing. Whereas if you spoke to someone here in a U.S. meetup, a real estate meetup, and you said, hey, you know, I found something in Malaysia that you can invest into, and I'm not really open to it, right? But you're over there and people are like, oh, I just invested in Malaysia. We have, you know, investments in the UK. We have investments here. And you're much more open to international investing because when you're in a very expensive place, it's like if we were in a meetup in New York City, which I kind of compare to Hong Kong, where not many people are investing there. There are some, obviously, but most people are looking for cash flow and chasing returns in other markets. And that's kind of how I thought Hong Kong was when I went there, because no one was really, maybe one person out of a meetup that was there was really investing in Hong Kong in places that in units that they were renting out. They had their own places, but that was something that was a little different. So when he brought in the U.S. and he said, hey, you know, we invest in the U.S. and I was talking to people, it offers it really minimizes your risk when you're in these different markets with different income streams that are coming from them that sometimes don't coincide. Obviously, with COVID, that was kind of a global pandemic. Obviously, is going to really change this. But in most areas, like when you had 2008, something like this, well, maybe other countries were harmed more than the U.S. was harmed in multifamily. So that might be something where you're kind of hedging your risk by going into different markets.
This podcast sounds fascinating, too. It's great that there is a podcast like that that really focuses on the foreign investor. But does it also sort of conversely deal with folks in the U.S. that want to invest in foreign markets?
Yeah, so I think about half our listeners, more than half our listeners are U.S. investors. And a lot of the information is very similar. But there are some shows in there that are really focused toward foreign investors. But the thing is that with everybody being really mobile and obviously with COVID and a lot of jobs going remote, there's a lot more people that are planning on not just leaving where they were living and going to another place in the country, but going to different places in the world. So people might love real estate investing, but saying, well, how do I do this if I'm in Europe or if I'm in Latin America or somewhere else? And that allows that, you know, that kind of information is what I try to bring professionals on and other investors that have worked with foreign investors. And we have shows that are really dedicated toward that. But a lot of the same information, a lot of the information on there is really, I love getting on people onto the show that are in different asset classes within real estate that I'm not in. So like farmland investing, debt note funds, all this kind of stuff that I'm not, a seasoned investor at, that I like learning about and possibly investing myself passively. So that's really what I focus, is trying to get information on there and putting it in like a 25-minute kind of piece so people can understand and say, hey, you know, multifamily is great and I love multifamily, but there's other asset classes out there that you can kind of spread some of your investment dollars over that you've allocated for real estate.
Yeah, I have a number of folks as well listen internationally, and a lot of times I get questions on regulations and what kind of restrictions are there to invest in syndications, for example. I mean, do you feel those kinds of questions, or how do you handle those when they're coming up?
Yeah, that's a great question. It really depends. Everybody has a different situation and a different, and my like call to action, which I'll do at the end of the show, is really like people that want to passively or actively invest will reach out to me. And I speak to people that are, because there's some people that are foreign that want to be active in investing in U.S. real estate, which is perfectly fine. And then there's some people that want to be passive and they just have a return in mind. And if they get paid that return, everything's fine. And so everybody has a different level of involvement that they want. So when someone's coming to me, I'm kind of pointing them in the right direction of where they should go. And usually how that's done is someone reaches out to me and I'm really just, in my return email back to them after we've had our call, I'll send back just a bunch of podcast links from my show for different professionals that they should reach out to. And hey, these are a couple attorneys, and listen to the one and see which one that you might mesh best with and reach out to them. And that's kind of the way it's going, because there's so many different facets to investing from the U.S. versus from a foreign country when you have additional tax obligations. And you need to have professionals in your home country while also in the U.S. that understand and make sure that you're paying the correct taxes, but you're also minimizing as much as you can legally your tax exposure in both countries. And we have such good there's such good tax implications, I guess you would say, here, or advantages in the U.S. for people that are investing in real estate, that it's great that people are able to come here and invest and receive returns that they might not be able to in their home market.
Right. Now, it's interesting, as we mentioned earlier at the beginning of the show, you're both an investor and an operator on various, say, sort of both sides of the syndication. What are some of the sort of pros and cons, would you say, on both sides, as an investor and as an operator?
I think it really comes down to what do you want to do? What's your real goal? I mean, so some people will, I'm only going to invest passively so I understand more about syndication so I can go and do it actively. And then there's going to be some people that say, I don't care anything about actively. I don't want to deal with any part of this. I just want to invest passively and make this high single digit cash on cash return that, you know, we can earn here. So it really just depends on where we're able to, what they're kind of focusing on, and then kind of figure out what the best path is. So when you're passive investing, yes, it's, I mean, I tell people with my passive investments, it takes like an hour or 2 hours a year to manage those investments, right? You get a monthly letter that comes in. You might have some questions. You write back to them here or there. You have your distribution that comes into your account, and that's and you forward a K-1 to your accountant, and you're kind of done with it. So that's a huge plus. But also, I don't really have legal control over when that's going to be sold. And obviously, they have a huge upside in becoming, having the asset make as much money as possible so they can receive their large portion of that afterwards. But you don't really have a complete say in it. So I'll talk like we're selling one asset right now and we're planning on selling another one. And with one of the assets we're selling right now, I was talking to one of my investors. And I was like, hey, you know, what do you feel like? Would you be interested in selling this? And they're like, oh, no, let's hold out. If, you know, hold out to the end to get as much money, which is kind of a risky situation. But I mean, I can listen to them and kind of take that into consideration. Or I can just say it doesn't matter. And I'm going to do what we want to do, you know, because we are the ones that are operating the investment. So that's one thing you don't have as much control when you're on the passive side. But also, you know, your return on time is very high because it takes a lot of time. I mean, we've looked at our last property we purchased was end of last year. It was like right around the beginning of Q4, and we haven't bought anything since. So it's 150 plus properties we've reviewed and haven't found anything. That's very time consuming. And it's a lot of calls that you have to be on, very time sensitive stuff coming from brokers in hot markets like this. So obviously there's going to be additional fees, like an acquisition fee, which is charged to compensate the operator for that. But you might just want to be on the passive side and say, hey, when you do find something, if it's once, twice a year, let me know. And I'll let you know if I'm interested. So it just kind of depends on where. And then also on the active side, it's not just you're just active in, you know, in general. I mean, you're really, what are you going to be doing? Are you the one that's going to be going and interviewing contractors? Are you going to be doing project management? Are you going to be doing the weekly calls with the property manager? Are you going to be doing investor relations? So there's really, after you found the property, really the work just starts then, where you have this business plan that you've developed with your partners and you've sold to your investors that you now have to act on. And so that's something that could take 3 to 5 years. And a lot of times in the investing, when you're getting into syndications, the first couple of years for operators is not really profitable. I mean, the only money they're really making is on the return of the money that they invested. Because when they're investing money into it, it's they're like a passive investor as well. But on the active portion of it, other than their acquisition fee up front, they're not really getting compensated that much monthly. So that's something else that people have to take into consideration. But there are some people that we speak to that just want to do, hey, turnkey investing and be active on it. And that's perfectly fine. I mean, you're going to have a lot more time you're spending. You're not going to have the ability of spreading your money over so many different units and so many different income streams. And that's something that you're going to have, in most cases, more volatility in your income. Because if you have a 5-unit property or a 10-unit property, you only have 10 income streams there. Whereas if you were passively investing in 100 units, now you have 100 income streams coming in, possibly say 5% vacant, 95 income streams coming in. And you're now able to, if there's a little shakeup at the property, like is COVID, you might have one property that just does terribly. And you might have, but over so many different units, you're going to see that there's not as much of a bump in the road. So.
Right. It's, you know, since about 2012, I think probably through 2016, sort of the standard was the value add proposition and, finding a property where you could do something to upgrade it and then turn it around. And sometimes people are turning it around in 2 years. But I think the standard is probably 3 to 5 years. Is that the same model that appeals to international investors?
Most international investors don't know too much about. It's funny, when I was at my first Hong Kong meetup, they didn't even know what multifamily was. And they're like, oh, just like lots of flats in one building. And I was like, yeah, that's exactly what it is. Because it's not a term that's like internationally known. But they, with value add, it's not really, they don't understand, you know, the building of a property, renting or selling of a property. But the value add is something that's, it's because it's a difficult thing to kind of explain in depth with how it really works. You can just say yes from someone that said, oh, we just go in and we raise rents. But, you know, that's a portion of value add that is what everybody really thinks. And that's what a lot of the guru programs, I call them, out there really sell. Hey, go into a property, you find a place with rents that are $950, and a block down the road, same size property is $1,100. And you'll know that, okay, I can raise rents to $1,100. And that's fine. I mean, but that's not really, that's not something like during COVID, no one was raising rents, no matter what people were saying. It's very risky to start raising rents when you can't evict people and when you don't know what's going to happen. I mean, we didn't raise rents last year until December, right? Until we kind of had an idea. Florida had reopened, where the majority of our units are. And when that happened, that was something that, okay, now we can kind of move forward with the business plan. But what we're really doing when we're doing value add, and like for one property we bought last year, we bought a 90 unit. It was really a 22 unit and a 68 unit. So it was two properties that most syndicators wouldn't deal with separately, but we put them together for 90 units in one syndication. They're about a block, two blocks from each other. But the 22 unit had a management fee. The guy was paying his now ex-son-in-law a 15% management fee, which is very, very high. I mean, if you bought a condo and had someone manage it, you know, it's usually 10%. And we had so many units in the area that we were able to get that management, we had that management fee down in the threes. So without really doing anything on that property, we were able to minimize fees by like 80% just on management, and much better management too, I should say. But so we don't have to, it's really going in when you're investing, especially if you want to avoid any type of hiccups when you have pullbacks, it's really minimizing costs and really increasing efficiencies. Because if you see, hey, why does it take you 5 weeks to turn a unit, right? Make it ready, rent it out, get someone else in there paying. If you can get it down to 3 weeks, I mean, right then, no rents have been added, increased, and you're still adding to the NOI though. And that's something that I don't think a lot of people look at. It's like the whole adage, you're selling a house for $500,000 and you tell your agent, if you can't sell us for $500,000, what can you do other than lowering the price? And then see what they say, because most people don't have anything else up their sleeve. It's the same thing with the value-add operators, other than raising rents. And obviously, rents are going to be raised during this. The whole process wouldn't work completely without raising some rents, but it's a much different proposition when you have to raise rents 10% or 12 or 15% over 3, 4, like you said, 5 years, compared to, hey, we're going to go in, raise rents 20% in the first year, and everybody's going to stay and pay it. Well, no, they're not. You know, you're going to have to switch over of all the people or the majority of the tenants. It's going to be huge cash flow issues. There's going to be all these type of problems that people don't kind of see and understand that are possibilities. So in value add, that's kind of what we're looking for. We're looking more for making efficiencies, and that's definitely a good way of doing it. And we feel the best way when you're trying to avoid having any issues when you're going through a pullback.
Do you feel that the international investors are more long-term investors? I mean, they just want that standard return over a longer period of time, or do they prefer that, you know, the big payout at the end of that, you know, the play for 3 to 5 years?
It really depends on the investor. I found it, and one of my friends was telling me that was in Hong Kong, and he was saying that you know, Chinese investors are much more oriented toward like gambling. So they're looking for making faster cash, more appreciation. I mean, when properties are being sold over there, like a new something new is being built in Hong Kong, you buy like tickets, right? To be able to then, you buy into a lottery to like be able to actually buy a new complex and a new unit when it's being built. And it's amazing. So you can buy a ticket and not even get the property, right? But so that's a whole different mentality from the U.S. But it's also something too, is that some investors I have, I think with a lot of these investors that come from places like we were talking about earlier, that didn't really have a cash flow, right? They don't have the ability to go and buy a property and make 7-8% cash on cash. They might come here and say, well, you know, that's fantastic. I have these properties in my home country that I'm keeping for appreciation and minimal cash flow. And now, hey, if they're, as I answering your question, they're more likely, I found, for ones that are looking for cash flow to accept lower cash on cash returns for properties, because the ability of them getting cash flow in their home market is not really a possibility. So that's, you know, if they might say, hey, I'll invest with you, I don't need any of these splits or anything like this, but they might be more open to like, hey, 8%. If you can give me a straight return at 8% or 9% paid quarterly, we're totally fine. And whatever else you make on top of it, I mean, that's kind of how you do it. And I see a lot of that with international investors willing to accept lower returns than a lot of U.S. investors that, you know, they contact me and say, well, someone tells me they're going to get 17%. Can you beat that? Well, it's not really how it works. And I don't really want to get involved with an investor that's kind of doing that, because that's something where, what happens if it brings back 14%? I mean, is that going to be an issue for you to do that? So it's just different mindsets of people going in, and different what their overall goal is a little bit reduced when it comes to property performance because of where they currently invest or where they currently live.
Right, right. What would you see that be a common mistake that you see investors make? You know, again, you've been able to look at it from both sides of the syndication experience as a LP and investor, as a operator. What do you think is a common mistake that folks make that you see that you think that people can learn from?
I think one of the first things that kind of I see, and it happens a lot now, is you have a lot of people that are getting into real estate investing, and on their first investment, they want to raise money from friends and family and everything like that. And that kind of makes me cringe a little bit, because I think with anything that you're investing into, I think you have to understand and you have to do it yourself, because there's going to be so many things you don't know. I mean, you can listen to 10,000 hours of podcasting and read 100 books on real estate, and there's still going to be things that pop up. Maybe you've alleviated a lot of issues by doing all that education up front, but that doesn't – what happens when you're trying to tell a tenant, hey, where's my rent on the – you know, and it's the fifth, and or hey, we're going to be raising rent $20, and you're doing this face to face. That's something that can only be learned and face to face. And it's also a thing too, is there's not anything written playbook that says when you accept the tenant that you're underwriting, right? Like, they have this, but they have this income, but they don't have this, or they have this. And that all has to be done when you're face to face, when you're actually actively investing. So, you know, people, it doesn't matter how small you start. I think starting with an investment you're 100% yourself, or like with your spouse or something like this, before you start going to friends and family or other people in your circle of influence and having them invest in your deals. And I think that would make them, you'll pick up so many things that you made mistakes on in your first deals that you can now minimize those. Or what happens in a lot of real estate deals is you're just, oh, you know, I'm going to put an extra margin of error here because there's going to be something that comes up that I have no idea. And I know that going in, but I don't know what it is.
Gotcha. In terms of things that you've done well that have worked out especially well for you, successes, what would you say was something that really, you know, really worked to your advantage and has continued to work well for you?
I think, like, you know, we're talking about how expensive current real estate is and everything like that going forward. And I don't want people to get frustrated and say, you know what, I'm just going to wait until the market changes or something like this. I think keep on reviewing. If you're an active investor or a passive investor, keep on reviewing deals and keep on reviewing the market and reading and learning about the market and all different, as you might consider, ups and downs of it. Because, you know, you'll do some deals that are going to be like doubles, triples, or home runs, and it's all at different times of the cycle. But if you're not out there looking at deals and you've kind of turned off, hey, I'm not going to look at any deals until this happens in the economy, well, that may never happen. I mean, you may never start. So that was one thing, like when I was buying in 06 and it was like, okay, well, that was like a single, you know, and then 08, I was like, okay, that's like a triple. And then you're buying in 09 and on in that low of the market. And you're like, oh, these are all like home runs. But it's all obviously now you're buying deals and you might not think it's that great. But if you're buying them correctly, you're reviewing the deals and it's a solid place to put your money. It's a solid place for your investors to put your money. You know, that's a great investment there. But it might not be representative of all your past successes, but it's something where you're still going to make money. You're going to earn a return. And I think most investors now are just scared with leaving money in cash in a savings account, right? Because I am. You know, you want to keep your money moving and keep some reserve, obviously, but you want to make sure that it's not eaten up by this inflation that we're seeing start up here in 2021.
Sure. That's great. Great advice. Well, we have, as you know, an audience of folks that are 50 years of age and older. They're either approaching retirement or already in retirement, and they're interested in real estate as a means to sort of either supplement their existing retirement income or, you know, longer term, maybe be able to work with their nest egg to get maximum returns and to be able to eventually maybe create a legacy that they can hand down to their family. In your realm of experience here, what do you think would be most helpful for that audience?
I think figuring out what your 5-10 year goal is. I mean, if you want to be more active, if you're looking to really put stuff more passively and kind of start enjoying life more, that would be something where, when you're looking at buying properties, make sure that you've vetted the property. You're looking at obviously the operator, and you're also looking at the property management company that they're using. And that's something that's not really talked about, but they are the people that are going to be talking to these tenants. And we're talking now about 7-8-figure deals and stuff like that in some circumstances. And the person that's actually collecting rent and talking to one of these 100 or 200 income streams tenants that you have in these properties might only be earning $40,000 or $45,000 a year. So the thing is that you have to make sure that that property manager has good people working for them, because those are going to be the people on their team that are going to be working at the property and seeing your tenants, your clients, on a daily basis. So that's another big thing too. And I would also say is, you know, look for properties. Just because a property is a little bit more expensive, buy a property in a good area, you know, quiet area, an area where you're going to see some kind of wave of gentrification that's coming through, even if you're on the end of it. I mean, that's where you see people coming in and spending money. And I wish some of my properties I bought were on, like, say, busier streets or more commercial areas. And they're fine, but the best ones I bought were a little quieter, still close to those conveniences, but they were on quieter areas. And they were able, and people stayed there longer. And the real name of the game, no matter if you become active or passive in real estate, is really keeping your tenants as long as possible, because that dramatically increases your NOI.
Big time. Yeah, great advice. Great advice. Well, what excites you about your business? It looks like you definitely have been growing quite a bit and made a number of investments. Well, what do you see for sort of your long term with your company and where you want to take it?
Where we see ourselves now is we're still, as we were saying, you know, we're looking at deals, we're seeing deals that hopefully finding some that pencil that we'll work with and bring some of our investors in with that we can buy and we can value add. And but the main thing, we're looking right now for lighter rehab properties. What we're also doing too is one of my partners is a developer, and that's something too that we're looking at is in the process of planning out a small multifamily complex. I believe it was 30. We're in the process of 30 or 35 units, figuring that out right now. But you know, building is something when these prices get so high, and even with the cost of building supplies, that's something too that we're seeing, that a property that we're selling that's 40 years old, it's pretty much the same price to build that property today, brand new. So. And it's a whole different exit strategy on that, because now you can sell it, you can do better finishes, and you can hold it for cash flow, or you can sell it. So building is one of the things that we're very much getting involved with, and I feel that that might be the play here for years to go until we have some sort of a little shakeup here where prices come back, because I look at price now, and even properties that we're selling, I just feel the pricing is just crazy. Even the ones we're selling, I feel it's really high even for that.
Oh yeah, definitely. Right now, that's and you mentioned the cost of materials for construction. It's just crazy too. I mean, mm-hmm. absolutely insane. So, yeah, that definitely gonna have to be some changes. and a lot of people say that's a given. It's just a matter of when. But well, we've kind of zipped ahead here a little faster than I'd hoped here. But we have a session now we call our Wrap It Up, where I ask you, it's kind of a lightning round, where I'll ask you a series of quick questions about resources that have been of value to you, and you'll get, you know, your answer, and our audience can draw upon that information for themselves as well.
Great.
Are you ready for it?
I am.
All right, let's do it. Favorite real estate book?
Donald Trump, Art of the Deal, my first book I read back in the 90s. Real estate book I read.
Yes, great book. How about favorite business book, just general business book?
80-20 Principle by Richard Koch, I believe that's how you pronounce it. He's an English guy, and it goes about Pareto's principle. And you can, it's a great, when you're flying in a plane, whenever that happens again, you can read it in one flight. And it really will change around your whole thinking on business and personal as well.
Great suggestion. What about most valuable website for success?
Websites I would check normally. I'm always on CNBC and seeing what's going there. So that's probably one of the biggest resource websites I use. So for one website, that's what I'd call it. And kind of seeing what's happening and what people are saying in residential, since it, you know, construction residential just carry over into other asset classes as well.
How about a favorite app?
I love the app Trello, T-R-E-L-L-O. And it's a great, it's great for putting goals onto. It's great for, I use it as a weekly task list. So it keeps everything organized, and it's free too. So it's fantastic. I have it on my desktop and then also on my phone. And so it just goes back and forth. So definitely look out for it if you're interested in kind of getting away from having a paper list to do, which I did for years, and doing it this way. And then anywhere where you have an idea that comes up, you can easily just pop it in there and you don't forget it. So
I like it. That's a great one. How about a favorite quote?
I love the quote, "Focus is Power" by Tony Robbins. And it's just exactly what it says. I mean, when you start focusing, you really start to achieve great success.
Yeah, great. Now here's our final question. This one, a little bit, you got to be a little creative here, but if you lost absolutely everything, all your assets, and you had to start all over, but knowing what you already know, and you only have $1,000 in cash, what would you do with that $1,000 to rebuild your real estate business?
I would start a real estate podcast about how I lost everything. And that's probably the best way of doing it. And just like you're doing it, you can touch so many people's lives and give them all this great information that they can now impart on their life.
Great idea. I'm sure there's a lot of folks here that just, have been, stirred in terms of their interest levels and some of the things that you're doing. Are you open to giving people contact information to be able, so if folks would like to reach you?
Yeah, sure. So if you're interested in passively or actively investing, you can go to my website. I have a direct link to set up a call with me, and it's schedulecharles.com. Schedulecharles.com, and it just goes to my personal website, charlescarrillo.com, and you can see all my links, my podcast, all my information. We can set up a 30-minute call and talk about where you are right now in your real estate career, where you want to be, and kind of where you see yourself in the future, and hopefully I can give you some pointers and point you in the right direction and build your real estate empire as we build ours.
That's great. I love it. We're called the Old Dogs REI Network, so we like our guests to close us out with their best old hound dog howl. Are you up for that, Charles?
Sure. I'll try my best here.
All right. Go for it.
Ow-woo!
Yep. All right. Hey, that'll work.
It's more like a wolf from that
Werewolf of London.
Wolf, yeah, Werewolves of London. Yeah. Pina Colada at Trader Vic's.
Wow. Well, thanks, Charles, for being on. I really appreciate some good information. I think we have a lot of folks that are active and passive investors, so I think they'll get some good stuff on both sides there.
Thanks so much, Bill, for having me on, and I appreciate all your time.
Well, it's my pleasure. And I also want to thank all our old dog listeners out there, too, for joining us. I know there's a lot of other things you could be doing right now, but the fact that you've taken the time to join us means a lot, and we really appreciate it. Please note, everything that Charles talked about today will be outlined in detail, and we'll have links, if there are links there, recap everything that was discussed, and you can find that at our website at olddogsreinetwork.com/blog, and you're going to look for the episode with Charles Carrillo. Well, that is the show for today. Remember, cash flow is king, and real estate investing the means. Until next time, keep moving forward, and may God bless.
Thank you very much for visiting the Old Dogs REI Network. We would greatly appreciate if you would stop by iTunes and let us know what you think of the show. We would love if you could subscribe to the podcast, give us a 5-star rating, and write a review. The more ratings and reviews we receive, the more visible the podcast will be to others. Thank you.